So we will begin this morning by hearing Senate File 3030.
Our first agenda item this morning is Senate File 3030, Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and members, this is a bill that requires health plans to cover private duty nursing services when an inpatient hospital stay would otherwise be required. The co-pays, deductibles, and other enrollee cost sharing would be the same as the health plan has for their inpatient hospital stay. And the private duty nursing services must be treated as a single course of treatment and not subject to separate enrollee cost sharing per day or hour or other increment of time. And the bill has a fiscal note that would generate cost savings to our public health plans programs. And I would be ready to answer any questions anyone might have.
Questions from the committee. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Berglund, when a private duty nurse can provide the same services in a home that would allow someone not to have to access more expensive services, seems like a really good idea to take advantage of that opportunity. My concern would be situations where someone decides that that's the option and the insurance company basically starts to put standards in place. We already know that we've got higher infection rates in this country than other countries. We've got higher infant mortality rates than other countries. And a lot of people think that it's because we have insurance driving medical decisions about good practices. And so I guess my concern is just that this doesn't become a means of lowering our healthcare standards, but instead is what you intend it to be, an opportunity to take advantage of cost savings when the opportunity is appropriate. So is there anything in your bill or any means of making sure that the medical profession is in control of determining when these are appropriate situations to utilize this kind of care?
Senator Berglund.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Olson, I assume it would be similar to what it is now. You know, if you're admitted to a hospital, you're admitted because a doctor has indicated that he would be or she would be caring for you during that hospital stay. And if a doctor believes that you could be released sooner or would not need to be admitted at all if you could get a private duty nurse coverage, then I'm assuming they would be the one that would order that.
Senator Olson.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Berglund, it seems like today the doctors aren't making those kinds of decisions independently because there are standards that the insurance companies or the health plans are setting for the number of days allowed that will be covered. And so then the doctor has to work within those parameters that aren't determined for medical reasons. So that's my concern, is that this just doesn't go down that road.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Olson, this bill isn't intended to solve all the problems of the insurance industries, you know, the way they work. It is intended to make sure that the private duty nursing is treated similar to how the hospital coverage would be treated in a person's policy. And some people opt to have, you know, high deductibles, or they opt to have policies that have limitations on certain types of coverage in the hospital. This isn't intended to try to change that. It's just intended to give the option of coverage for private duty nursing instead of hospitalization when that would be appropriate.
Senator Coring.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Berglund, can you just give me a hypothetical? I guess I don't understand this. So give me a hypothetical situation so I can understand this better.
Senator Berglund.
Well, I guess pick something that somebody might have to go to the hospital for.
Yeah.
And let's just say that they could get by with an outpatient procedure if they could go home and have a private duty nurse available to be taking care of their post-operative needs for a day or two. But if that private duty nurse wasn't available, then the procedure would be done on an inpatient basis, and it would be more expensive.
Senator Coring.
And you said there's savings, Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, you say there's savings. Where do the savings come in? Where do those come from?
Senator Berglund.
Well, if you look at the fiscal note, what you'll see is that the medical assistance savings would be there to the extent that private payment for private duty nursing services would be substituted for MA payments for the service. So, in other words, Medicaid is a payer of last resort. And if a benefit is available in an insurance policy, then Medicaid would expect the insurance policy to pay first. If that benefit isn't available and the person otherwise would be eligible for Medicaid, then Medicaid would pay for the service for low-income individuals who otherwise are eligible for Medicaid.
And so then the Medicaid, that's the savings that mm-hmm. we're realizing.
Mm-hmm.
How do you, how do they come up with a number like this number of savings, just guessing that somebody could have their health care provided in an outpatient kind of setting? I guess I don't know how you come up with that savings number. But
Maybe this will help on page 6 of the fiscal note. It indicates that once this bill is fully implemented, and it talks about the reduction in medical assistance spending for private duty nursing by 14.6% over time. That doesn't speak to more directly, Senator Coring, your question of how is it that we come up with that number, but that's where the savings is coming from. Senator Berglund.
Senator Coring, I'm sure they have looked at their claims experience in relationship to the number of people that otherwise have insurance.
Any additional questions from members? Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, I don't know if there's anyone here who wants to testify on the bill. I don't have any witnesses.
I don't have anyone on my list. Is there anyone that wishes to come forward and speak to this bill?
Not, then I would move that Senate File 3030 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Senator Berglund moves that Senate File 3030 be laid over for possible inclusion. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? No. Motion is adopted. Senator Berglund, would you like to continue on with the next item, which is Senate File 2337?
Well, these are amendments to the omnibus bill, and the number of the bill will be 2337, but we're not actually hearing that whole bill today. So which item would you like to take first, Madam Chair?
The first item on the agenda is the State Operated Services Plan.
Okay. Then we'll need to have the document JW16-1.
I'm just going to repeat that we're going to take up the discussion on state-operated services. I believe that there are some other members in the building that might be interested in hearing this discussion. The document being distributed is JW16-1. Senator Coring.
Okay, so I don't know. For some reason, I'm not following. So, okay, so now we have before us Senate File 2337, and we're hearing amendments and adopting amendments? Or if I have an amendment, would that be appropriate?
Senator Coring, this is kind of follows the path that we've been going down for the last couple of meetings, where Senate File 2337 is the overall vehicle that we will be using for
I didn't know that
the omnibus
today.
Bill. Okay. It's 2337. And so
Madam
the amendment Senator
this is
Burgoyne.
Not the last time we'll be hearing the omnibus bill, but we're taking three items that have budget implications today
and then members can
Senator
offer
Coring.
Amendments.
So it's
when?
Our way to give notice when we actually have the full document.
So we're here.
If you have something else you want scheduled as an amendment to the bill, let me know, Senator Coring, and we'll put it on an agenda. But if you have an amendment you want to offer the day we have the bill in front of us, then you can do that too.
So today we're going to hear, our plan is to hear three amendments to the overall omnibus bill, state-operated services, the birth record surcharge, and housing with services rates requirements. And there will be another meeting or more where we will have opportunities to hear additional amendments and certainly entertain amendments that members of the division might have. Senator Berglund.
So, Madam Chair, I would move this amendment, and I'll explain it. You remember when Dr. Sulik came and presented their plan to us, one of the features of the plan was to create these PERTs and to do it in partnership with community-based hospitals or other organizations. And one of the reasons, not the only reason, but one of the reasons for doing that was to get an organization that was already Medicare certified to be the partner. Then the state didn't have to go through the Medicare certification process, which can be a little bit time consuming. When a private organization is your partner, they bill for Medicaid and Medicare, and they keep those receipts. It occurred to me that it might not be possible for every one of these programs that might be converted in the future to a PERT to get a community partner in as timely a fashion as we might need it. And so it seemed to me that at least going forward, these new services should be able to keep their own earnings. Today, state-operated services programs that have earnings, the earnings go into the general fund. And the program does not get to keep those earnings. They have to rely on other appropriations from this budget division's budget. So the first part of this amendment would create a state-operated services account in the special revenue fund. and would indicate the revenue generated by the new state-operated services would be deposited into this state-operated services account. And it would be for intensive residential treatment services, foster care services, and psychiatric extensive recovery treatment services, all of which could have Medicaid earnings, but also could have appropriations from the state. So that's in case there are not private partners that would be doing the billing themselves, would allow state-operated services to do the billing and keep the receipts for these services. The next part of the bill deals with modifications to the plan that was developed by the Department of Human Services. And the first part of this deals with the Anoka Regional Treatment Center, and it is simply modifying the law we already passed, indicating that they would be to establish partnerships with private and public hospital organizations, community mental health centers, and other mental health community service providers and community partnerships, but that the programs would be staffed by state employees, and that the planning for this would be accomplished by October 1st of 2010 or before, and there would be a report to the legislature by November 30th, 2010. And the language is strengthened about engaging stakeholders, and it also allows any savings that are generated as a result of transitioning patients from the Anoka Metropolitan Regional Treatment Center during this biennium to be used to create supported housing that would be staffed by state employees. One of the problems that we have at Anoka is getting people out the back door. And whatever other services are created that might be more appropriate for people, those services are going to have a similar problem. And so the supportive housing that's described here would be envisioned to be a type of supported housing that would be perhaps serving more aggressive patients, serving hard-to-place patients that are not readily placed in other supportive housing that might be available in the metropolitan area. This is one of the reasons why the facility in Ely has metropolitan patients, because they are willing to take patients that other facilities in the metro area are not willing to take. And we could be much more efficient with our dollars and with our services if we are creating some additional supported housing. So that's the idea behind that part of the amendment.
Senator Berglund, if I could just interject. You mentioned Ely. I think you meant to say Eveleth.
Excuse me.
The Eveleth facility.
Eveleth.
And to be clear, the planning for this transition is to be completed by October 1st of 2010.
That's right. This year.
Senator Berglund.
Then moving on, we have a general fund appropriation to the commissioner for fiscal year 2011, and $600,000 of it would be for a community collaborative to continue a crisis center in the Mankato area. And we further indicate that the commissioner would obtain legislative approval prior to discontinuing that funding in the future. And this would be a base level funding that would continue in the future. So this the vision here is that this crisis center would become a private, public-private collaborative, but that they have a number of people that come to them who are either underinsured or uninsured, and so they would still need a state appropriation to help them cover the costs for that group of people.
Okay.
But otherwise, this community collaborative would be billing Medicaid and Medicare themselves and keeping those receipts. Then $106,000 would be appropriated to maintain the building in Eveleth that currently houses the Community Transition Services. And the plan they have to go ahead and create psychiatric intensive therapeutic foster home would move ahead, but the commissioner would be requesting a waiver to allow CADI funding for this service so it could be provided in the same building that they're using now. And if the federal government does not approve the waiver, then the commissioner would continue to pay for the lease until a new occupant is secured or until the lease expires. Then $900,000 would be to operate the Community Behavioral Health Hospital in Wadena. This would be a one-time appropriation to give that facility longer to secure community hospital partner for the creation of a PERT. Once a community partner would be established, there would not need to be layoffs at that location. But we really believe that this is not something that can be accomplished by May 1st, certainly. And we think it may take a good part of the rest of this biennium to get that partnership in place. Then $700,000 would be appropriated kind of as a deficiency appropriation for the dental clinics. We had the long-term fix for the dental clinics in the bill we heard that restores critical access dental funding. This would be needed for the deficiency that they have incurred so far during this biennium.
Madam
then
Chair.
2 points.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Berglund. When you said this money is needed by these particular clinics named in Brainerd, Cambridge, Faribault, Fergus Falls, and Willmar, are those the only clinics there that have been statewide a deficiency, or why these particular towns?
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, these are the dental clinics. And these are the only dental clinics that the state operates.
Okay.
Then
Senator Berglund.
2.8 on line 3.29 is to convert the Minnesota Neuro Rehabilitation Hospital in Brainerd. This hospital is losing, or will, either has lost or shortly will be losing their Medicare certification. They have been operating as an enterprise operation, but with the loss of potential loss of their Medicare certification, they will no longer be able to operate as an enterprise operation. So this $2.8 million is needed. Otherwise, this facility would have to close as well. Then we have $7 million on page 4 for the MITO program and request that that program be allowed to convert to PERTs, to intensive transitional foster homes and other community-based supported services, maintaining the employees that are currently working at the MITO program. And again, if the state is not able to obtain partners for the PERT operation or operations, then they would be able to move ahead and get that licensed under the state, and their revenues would be deposited in this account that we have created at the beginning of the bill. And there would be base level funding for the PERTs, but not for the foster care homes in this bill, because we believe after the initial startup funding that those foster homes, once they become occupied, can be operated as enterprise services. Then on lines 4.24, we instruct the commissioner not to move beds from the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center to the psychiatric nursing facility at St. Peter. And then we instruct the commissioner to finish out the deficit or the shortfall that they have due to primarily cuts that have been made by the governor, and to make up the rest of the $6 million that is not appropriated for in the bill by maximizing budget savings through strategic employee staffing. That would mean vacancies that would not need to be filled, and then the employee suggestion box that they already had in their plan, but we are expecting that to produce far less in savings than had originally been presented to this committee. And then we allow the commissioner to seek certification or approval from the federal government for new services that might be eligible for federal financial participation. Now, I think we should probably talk about the fiscal note just a little bit. And one of the reasons it's taken so long to hear this proposal is because of difficulties that we've been having with the fiscal note. And I'll just explain to you exactly what they are. When the department presented their proposal to us, which this is just really slight modification of their proposal, it's not a great deviation from their proposal. In some cases, it's giving some of the services a little more time to transition into a new service, and in other cases, it's asking that other services other than PERT services be created to make sure there will be adequate services for patients and opportunities for our well-trained state employees to be employed in. Well, if we have a bill to do the same thing that the department was proposing to do, then the Department of Management and Budget is telling us that we have to replace the lost federal funding that otherwise would go to, or revenues that would go to the general fund. If the department does this, those lost revenues would simply be in the next biennium's forecast.
And Senator Berglund, could you pull the microphone a little closer?
And I guess I feel like it really isn't a fair standard for us, who really should be approving any of these plan changes anyway, to have to fill the void left in the general fund by a change in service levels.
Senator Berglund, could you back up and restate what the primary problem is with us having to recognize this, the loss?
Well, if you look on the first page of the fiscal note, you'll see under revenues, under general fund, you see a little over $2 million. Those are revenues that are anticipated to be lost, and actually this proposal loses less revenues than the department's own proposal does, because we are delaying and giving some of these programs a little more time to become converted. They are indicating that they believe we have to appropriate money in order to fill the lost revenues to the general fund.
Senator Prettner-Solin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Berglund, could you just repeat the part you said that with our bill we need to make up the lost federal dollars, but the department with their proposal, what did you say they
It would simply Senator show Berglund. Up in the forecast.
Okay.
So if you turn to page 6 of the fiscal note, it's further broken down. And they're claiming that there will be lost revenues of $1.7 million for the Mito conversion, which isn't something I'm inventing in this amendment. It was proposed by the department anyway. And then they're claiming that we have to come up with $300,000 for the closing of Cold Spring, which has already happened. I mean, it's already happened. It happened last October. And this amendment has no mention of Cold Spring in it. So I just need to say for the record that I have an objection to this part of the fiscal note.
Senator Olson. Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Berglund. I know we've had this discussion over the years several times, and not just in this committee, but also I think in Senator Rest's committee. But ultimately, when there's a disagreement about how to interpret a budget and we set the budget, isn't it ultimately our decision in terms of the fiscal note and the implication that we believe it will have? I mean, aren't we getting advice when we get these fiscal notes? But sometimes if there's a difference of opinion about whether how it should be interpreted or whether it's a money that the department has already absorbed, that they, I mean, is that ultimately our decision, or are we bound by this?
Senator Berglund.
Well, a lot of times we can look at a fiscal note and decide that maybe we don't think they need 4 staff people, and so we give them 1 or half of 1 or something. I think this is a little bit of a different issue, and I mean, we can simply choose not to fund this, but, you know, the fact is that these revenues are going away. Whether we pass a bill or whether the department changes the way they're delivering services, these revenues are going to go away. I mean, you know, if we have to replace these revenues, I believe it is a perverse incentive to getting our services to be more efficient. I'll just give you an example. Let's talk about Anoka for a minute. Let's just say for the purposes of this discussion that we could replace all of the services at Anoka with lower cost, more efficient services that would reduce the length of stay, similar to what the cabs have done in rural Minnesota. Today, because there are lengths of stay that are longer than 30 days at Anoka, the counties are paying money, and that money is not going to state-operated services. It is going to the general fund. So if we could replace Anoka this year with more efficient services, there would be a huge loss to the general fund because there would be expected shorter lengths of stays, and the counties would no longer be having a county share that they would be paying for receiving those services. I just believe this idea that we have to make up that money is a perverse incentive to getting our program to be more efficient and to be providing the right level of services to our clients.
Senator Corn.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Berglund, I too, over the years, sometimes, I tell my constituents this, I say, you know, really the legislators, for the most part, are not really steering the ship. I think we get fiscal notes, and the people that are, I don't know if bureaucrats a bad word, but career bureaucrats give us a fiscal note. It kind of steers us in a direction that they kind of want us to go. And so do you think we should have an explanation about that Cold Spring portion, or do you think we should just forget about that or have them explain why they have that in there?
Yeah,
Senator Berglund.
I think that might be an interesting conversation to hear.
I'd like to hear that if somebody wants to explain that.
I see Mr. Tesner in the audience. I'm sure he's
anxious to come forward.
I think that this part of the fiscal note came from the Office of Management and Budget.
Okay.
Dr. Sulik?
I don't see Dr. Sulik in the room. Okay. If there's someone from Management and Budget that would like to come forward, I'd invite them to do so as well. Mr. Tesner, welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
Would you like to explain this part of the fiscal note?
Mr. Tesner, we're going over the fiscal note, and we're having some questions, particularly surrounding the Cold Spring, the closure of Cold Spring, on page 6 of the fiscal note. Mr. Tesner.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the Cold Spring Hospital was closed, I believe, in October. We ran into a situation where the there was some staff turnover. We were having trouble recruiting both psychiatry as well as nursing staff and, I believe, social workers because of the uncertainty of the future of the cross-state operated services, CBHHs, knowing that there was going to be some redesign. We had the capacity in other hospitals, so we made the decision in October to close it and really mothball the program pending the redesign activities and all the meetings we were in over the course of fall and into winter. Initially, we were thinking that the Cold Spring Hospital would become a step-down level of care that would again generate revenue. So we chose at that time not to change the revenue forecast. So we left the forecast, which I believe is $300,000. That's where that number comes from, which is typically what we would have taken in that hospital. We left that in place pending the potential change into a different level of care. Through the redesign meetings and the input that we got from the stakeholders, it was apparent that there wasn't a need for that level of care in that site, and that decision was made after the February forecast, so it would have been our intent to recognize this in the November forecast.
Senator Berglund.
So, Madam Chair and Mr. Tesner, why is it in a fiscal note relating to this amendment? This amendment doesn't even mention Cold Spring.
Mr. Tesner.
That's a good question. Hold on. I need to take a look at the fiscal note. Okay.
Mr. Tesner.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, in preparing the fiscal note, there's a projected savings of 6.006. Of which we're assuming the Cold Spring closure is part of that. If we assume that Cold Spring is part of that, then we have to include the loss of revenues to be in line with the budget rules.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Mr. Tesner, there isn't anything in the bill that says you have to assume that the closure of Cold Springs gets you your $17 million. All the bill says is that you would be maximizing budget savings through strategic employee staffing, which would mean holding some vacancies when they occur, and implementing other cost reductions in cooperation with state-operated services employees.
Madam Chair, Tesner.
I understand, and if the intent was not to include the Cold Spring in that, we would have to take another look at this fiscal note.
I think we would welcome the opportunity to have you take another look at the fiscal note. Senator Berglund, are there other things in the fiscal note that you wanted to continue discussing?
I still believe that this this $1.7 million loss due to the conversion of MITO to other services that the department has no plan to pay for it's certainly questionable as to why we would have to pay for it if they don't have to pay for it.
Mr. Tesner, that's probably another area that we would ask you to take another look at.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd be happy to.
Thank you.
So that's
Senator Corn.
$2 million?
Isn't this fun, Senator Corn?
It really
Corn?
Is.
Okay. Senator Olson.
Well, and Madam Chair and Senator Berglund, I think this just underscores, again, a point that we keep coming back to over and over. When we have perhaps a reform proposal, the legislature, to direct a department to do something that's going to save money, Then we get a fiscal note for sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars for the staff that it's going to take them to look for the savings. When the executive branch decides that they want someone to figure out how to cut 5% from their budget, they don't get extra money to come back with that budget proposal. That's part of their job. And likewise, in a situation like you're describing, if they're going to have to make the cuts anyway, I mean, there isn't the extra money for them to be doing something, so why are we having to build it back into the budget, I think is what you're saying, or take it out of our budget to do the same thing. I think we have to play on a level playing field and call into question these kinds of assumptions, because this is how we creep up our budgets on the administrative side when we don't ask these kinds of questions.
Senator Berglund, if I may, I have a couple of questions for Mr. Tesner on the bill itself, or perhaps some comments, as long as you are with us. And I wanted to just point out that on line 1.30, where it talks about engaging stakeholders, and I really want to highlight and mention that, because I think if there was a one glaring omission in this whole discussion, it was the apparent overt omission in so many communities from having those discussions. And so I hope that it's been made clear in this bill and in our correspondence to this point that we fully expect the stakeholders to be engaged in the process. And by all means, when you are talking about making substantial changes in perhaps closing facilities and members of the legislature's districts, I would ask that your office communicate with the affected members. We should not read about this in the newspaper. We certainly shouldn't hear about it as budget proposals come forward. And Mr. Tesner, I'm wondering, on 1.27, Senator Berglund noted the planning transition date's been changed to October 1st of 2010. Mr. Tesner, are you going to be able to achieve that goal? Mr. Tesner.
Madam Chair, it is our practice to adhere to the expectations of the legislature in statute.
Madam Chair.
Senator Berglund.
I can tell you for a fact that there are discussions that have begun, because I've been involved in two or three of them myself to make sure that they were happening.
And further, Mr. Tesser, on the bill on 2.33, this is regarding the Eveleth facility. It's noted that the commissioner shall make diligent efforts to sublease the space. And again, I just point that out. I think that that is something that we are asking for, and we are seeking more than a good faith effort in assistance there.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we've begun those conversations with the landlord, which is the City of Eveleth. And the formal notification will be going out, I think, on or about the 1st, that which would be Friday, Saturday, somewhere in there. And then we'll begin the formal negotiations to make sure that we live up to our obligations, including ensuring that there's a sublease if that's necessary.
Senator Berglund or Mr. Tesner, outside of the bill, what has the communication been, or what should we expect that the affected employees, what have they been told? Have they been issued notices? I think there's a lot of question in some of these communities about the status of their employment. What can you address that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the first phase of the changes has been implemented. That began about a little over a month ago with employees receiving notices of being at risk. There were 168 employees notified. The decision day for those notices was this past Friday. The effective date will be this Friday for the separations. So for the employees in that first phase of the reductions, that essentially is almost complete. The second phase of the plan, if you'll recall, had to do with both Anoka and Meadow, where there's existing no layoff language. We had hoped that we would find a resolution to that and relief from that language. We have not been able to do that, so we're considering what our next steps need to be.
Madam Chair.
Senator Berglund.
And Mr. Tesner, if this legislation is passed and signed by the governor, then would you be calling people back that have been given layoff notices that would be completed by the end of the month?
Mr. Tesner.
Senator, if we're directed to do that by statute, we would have no choice to do that. But I want to emphasize the changes that we've instituted thus far are a part of our effort to become more responsive to the patients that are coming to our door, changing those levels of care, and to operate more efficiently. Now, having said that, you know, if we're directed by the legislature to reopen or rehire staff, then we would have to comply with that.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Mr. Tesmer, I think we've made it abundantly clear that we do not believe closing the dental clinics is going to serve anybody better.
Mr. Tesner.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we have delayed the closure of the dental clinics for 30 days pending the outcome of the legislative session, specifically for that purpose or in response to those concerns.
So,
Senator Berglund.
So, Madam Chair and Mr. Tesner, then the other employees that would be at risk that we would be directing you to maintain would be at the Wadena site. Would that be correct?
Mr. Tesner.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the impacted sites included Wadena, Wilmer, both going from hospital level care to that subacute step down level of care.
I'm talking about in this amendment.
Okay, I'm sorry, in this amendment. Yes, the impact in the Wadena site actually, because of attrition, included one employee who claimed a job in a different state agency.
Mr. Tesman, were there notices given to employees at the Eplith facility?
Madam Chair,
Mr.
there
Tesner.
Were. Yes.
So, Mr. Tesner, there were notices given to employees at Wadena, notices given at Eplith. Were there other communities that were affected with those notices? Mr. Tesner.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Wadena, Wilmer, CBHHs, the Eveleth Mental Health Facility, and the Mankato Crisis Facility.
Senator Bergen, I can only say if I were one of those affected employees in one of those locations and I were listening to this hearing, I'm not exactly sure what I might be thinking if I'm Senator Bergen.
Madam Chair, we're doing the best we can here to try to make sure that there is more continuity of the employees. And as I said, we would have had this hearing earlier, except for the difficulties that we've been having with the fiscal note.
Let me try to ask a question in a different way. For those employees in those jurisdictions that have received notices with successful passage of this legislation and with a signature from the governor, will those notices be rescinded? Mr. Tesner.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the staffing reduction process will be complete this Friday. So I'm assuming it's not likely this bill would have traveled all of those places and been signed into law by then. And if directed, we would be contacting those employees and reinstating them. I'm not sure what that process would be. I'd have to talk with our labor folks. But there is a process to recall people.
Okay. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Mr. Tesner, have there been any notices given to the employees in Brainerd?
Mr. Tesner.
Madam Chair, there have not.
Mr. Tesner, would you like to elaborate?
Madam Chair.
Senator Berglund.
And Mr. Tesner, there's no guarantee that the legislature is going to appropriate that money to make that facility able to continue operating either. I mean, this is kind of a two-way street, you know.
Mr. Tesner.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, I'm sorry, I misunderstood. We have not, you were talking about the Minnesota New Rehab Hospital and the trouble we have with the funding for that facility. Our plan, if you'll recall, was to adjust the staffing levels in the NIDO program to this new model, which would have achieved a substantial savings both against the $17 million budget deficit as well as funding the transition of the Brainerd Minnesota New Rehab Hospital into a different set of services. Not being able to utilize that strategy because of the no layoff language, we are taking into consideration now other alternatives to achieve our budget. If it doesn't get resolved, we will have to issue layoff notices, but at this point, we have not taken that action.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Mr. Tesner, the no layoff language doesn't affect Brainerd.
Mr. Tesner.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Berglund, the reason we haven't taken an action is we believe firmly that the services that are currently constructed inside the New Rehab Hospital are best redesigned into this other model in order for us to respond to the patients coming to our door. We are looking at ways that we can protect that resource up in the Brainerd area. We haven't landed on a plan at this point.
Senator Berglund.
And Mr. Tesner, I would just also point out to you that the changes that were to be made at Wadena and Wilmer were scheduled to happen after May 1st, not by May 1st in the schedule that you gave us.
Additional questions from the committee? Senator Sharon.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Tesner, on the Mankato Crisis Center, the notices have gone out. There's about 14 employees, if I remember correctly. But it's indicated in the plan that you presented prior to our being successful with this, should we be successful, that the Behavioral Health Center in St. Peter would be picking up some of the responsibilities of the Crisis Center in Mankato. Have you changed the employee level or transferred any of the 14 employees to that facility? And what kinds of question one. Question two is, deliberate conversations have occurred for planning for the interim between May 1st and the implementation of this process to serve this community's crisis needs? And with whom in the community have you spoken to about how to coordinate that care?
Mr. Tesner.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, the St. Peter CBHH is prepared to take individuals who would be in crisis and need to be evaluated or stabilized in lieu of the of being admitted to the crisis site. So that's our interim plan. There's a meeting, I believe, happening this week with counties and providers. I'm not actually sure who all is there besides the counties, but I believe there's other providers invited to ensure that there is an interim plan once the crisis site goes down. The county group in that region has convened a planning group that has issued an RFP for the provider that will take over that site and operate that service. They're anticipating that it would start as early as June 1st or July 1st or August. They're giving some leeway to the providers to come in with how quickly they could ramp up the service. We are at the table in those discussions and will be in support of that plan. And I'm speaking Dr. Reed Sulik's administration, not just state-operated services, because some of the funding that they're looking at is allocated, I believe, through mental health grants. So we believe that within a month, that new service will be up and viable, and we're working towards getting it as quickly as possible.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Tessner, I understand the need to reform and to make some changes, but if you could just explain the simple mind why you are giving the notices before the end of the legislative session, because certainly the department would have felt that there was going to be some readjustment by the legislature on a huge proposal like this. I can't quite understand why the notices are going out before we've had a chance to debate this.
Mr. Tessner.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, the planning for this change in the way that we deliver services began in earnest last early summer. As it became apparent of the size and scope of our budget pressures, it was apparent that we needed to have a concise plan that was going to not only achieve better services for people but save dollars. We're really at this point up against a wall. If we had chosen to wait and for some reason the efforts of the legislature were not successful, we would be faced with laying off more people, closing more programs outside of a plan that provides what we believe is a necessary level of service. The timing is unfortunate. We recognize that. As Madam Chair has noted, it has left our employees somewhat confused and befuddled. We are trying to keep them as aware as we can as this process unfolds and ensure that they have the most current information. But the timing simply is driven by our intent to protect our core services, change as little as we can, impact as few employees as we can, and ensure that we're providing the best services that we can with the dollars that we have.
Mr. Tessner, I fear that these employees that have received notices are more than confused. They're losing their jobs. This wreaks havoc on families. And we had an opportunity, we had about 30-day opportunity to minimize that havoc on those families. It's very unfortunate. And for the record, they're more than, it's not confusion. We have disrupted their lives. And right now, there are families that are wondering how they're going to pay their mortgage and how they're going to put food on their table. Senator Sharon.
Just one more question, Mr. Tessner. The employees that have been laid off in the Mankato Crisis Center, they've given their layoff notices, and you had to do that because of contract kinds of issues. Do you know if because we're making, the state's making this portion of the contribution to the public-private partnership in the area, are they obligated to pull in these employees to staff up and to develop this new approach in the Mankato area for dealing with crisis?
Mr. Tessner.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, I don't know that they're obligated. It doesn't mean that they couldn't reach out and try to recruit people, but there aren't any conversations at this point for them, those entities, to be required to hire state employees in those capacities.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, if you think there needs to be some additional language to this, if you would just let me know.
Thank you.
Mr. Tessner, I know that Senator Berglund and members of the division will appreciate your efforts on reviewing and expediting a fiscal note for us. And to Senator Berglund, I know that I can speak for several members that aren't members of this division that have provisions in this bill, and I know we're all very appreciative of your efforts in work on this very difficult issue.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Berglund.
It seems pretty simple when you get an amendment put together, but it's a lot of work to get it here. So.
Okay. All right.
I would move that this amendment be recommended to be passed and laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Senator Berglund recommends that JW 16-1 amendment be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator Berglund. The next discussion item amendment is birth record surcharge.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members,
members, that's the document is SCS 2337 A-2, the A-2. Senator Berglund.
This amendment would increase the surcharge on birth records and would provide money to the Minnesota Birth Defects Information System and would, in addition to that, generate some savings for our budget. And the fiscal note is in your packet.
Savings to our budget. Any questions?
Madam Chair,
Senator Fischbach.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, maybe we could get a little more explanation of that, because I guess I see that there's 1.5 that's appropriated to this Minnesota Birth Defects Information System, and according to the fiscal note, the new surcharge will raise 2.5. Say on page 3, under assumptions, almost to the bottom of the proposed fee would generate roughly 2.5 per year. And then we use 1.5 for the birth defects system. Mm-hmm. So I get maybe a little more explanation so I can better understand.
Well, the remainder then would be appropriated to the Department of Health to help offset the budget deficit that we're facing.
Senator Fischbach.
So, Madam Chair, Senator Berglund,
It would make more of their operations, Madam Chair and Senator Fischbach, fee supported rather than general fund supported.
All right.
Senator Berglund.
Are there any other questions?
I don't see any. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to speak, address this? Okay. Senator Berglund.
If not, then I would move that the A2 amendment be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
On Senator Berglund's motion.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
I haven't had a chance to really take a look at this yet, but where does this, Senator Berglund, where does this put us in line as far as charges with the other states around and what is the charge right now? And there's a lot of information here I haven't had a chance to digest.
Senator Berglund.
Well, there is a $3 surcharge now, and so we'd be increasing it $10.
Madam Chair and Senator
Berglund. Senator Rosen.
Where does that put us in line with other states?
I think there's step forward. If you would identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members, Barb Julek, CFO, Department of Health.
Ms. Julek, welcome.
Current fees and surcharges for birth certificates are $16. Senator Berglund is correct. Of that $16, $3 is the surcharge for, I think, goes to the Children's Defense Fund. This would add $10 to bring it to $26. This would put us the second highest in the nation behind the state of New York. The average charge is about just under $16.
Okay. Any further questions? Ms. Julek, thank you. Senator Berglund. Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair and Senator Berglund, the 12 FTEs, does that seem kind of like a lot?
Well,
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, we always take a look at the FTEs that have been requested for everything at the end, and then we make adjustments if that's necessary, if we feel it's necessary because of sometimes we believe that some of the FTEs kind of overlap and could be reduced, but we generally look at that at the end. So the omnibus bill may not be providing 12 FTEs.
And Madam Senator Chair, Rosen. And Senator Berkley.
They're already collecting this money. Mm-hmm. They're just going to ask for a little bit more. And so it is kind of hard to understand why we would need that many more FTEs. You know, I just have to be honest. When I look at the proposals that come in for requests for staffing, sometimes I just have to assume that if there's been a reduction taken by the governor in the overall budget, that there's an attempt to try to make up some of that.
And I would just say, Senator Rosen, this is, I think as you're pointing out, this is perhaps not unique to this fiscal notice. We'll continue to try to iron those differences out. Additional questions from the committee? Senator Berglund.
I renew my motion.
Senator Berglund renews her motion that the A2 amendment be adopted and laid over for possible inclusion. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion is adopted. Next topic is the Housing with Services Rates Requirements Modification. And I believe that is the A4.
Right.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, members, this is a proposal that was in our budget bill last year. It was not ultimately adopted. The savings are a little bigger this year than they were last year when we did this in our omnibus bill. The proposal is one where we would be providing counseling to people who would be seeking to move into a housing with services establishment. And the counseling would be provided through the senior linkage line. A certificate would be provided to people that have completed the consultation, and then when people go to move into a housing with services program, they would be presenting this certificate. If they haven't got the certificate, then the housing with services would be obliged to refer them to the consultation. And the reason that the department has generated savings is because oftentimes people that move into housing with services don't always understand that they are going to possibly use up their resources fairly quickly. And they're not always aware that there might be less costly services available that could meet their needs. And so the fiscal note anticipates then that people that otherwise would be either needing assistance with the payment for the services from the state or would be spending down fairly quickly and then needing assistance for the services from the state, that the number of people in that category would be diminished.
So, Senator Berglund, this is a way for those individuals to better coordinate the services that
better
they
understand
need.
What their options are and to help people get their needs met in a way where they might not need to spend down all their resources.
Senator Olson.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Berglund. I'm just wondering, as a practical matter, kind of how this would work. Let's just say somebody breaks their hip and has to go to the hospital, and once they're no longer needing hospital services, but they need care, in order to transfer to the nursing home, a nursing home type of facility for care, would they have to undergo this kind of evaluation first, or as a practical matter, when would this come into play?
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, this is only for housing with services, not nursing facility services. So this is like assisted living. And usually when people are making that kind of a transition, they're moving out of a home or an apartment building, and it's a planned thing that they're doing, and this would just fit into their planning then.
Additional questions or from members? Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to speak? Okay. Senator Berglund on the A4.
Madam Chair, I would move that the A4 amendment be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
On Senator Berglund's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator Berglund.
Members.
Next item on the agenda is item number 4, Senate File 2986, Senator Erickson Ropes.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. I have a bill before you that many of you will remember we talked about at length in the policy committee, and got a fiscal note of zero from back for the first time, was sent back for a revaluation of that fiscal note, and it came back zero again. And I also have a minor amendment, the A9 amendment. If you'd like, I could start off with that.
Senator, you want to just explain the amendment?
Yes. In the previous committee, we made additional a few changes. And one of them had to do with deleting all the references to county-based purchasing. We forgot to delete it out of the title. So the A9 amendment is simply a technical cleanup of by deleting county-based purchases out of the title of the bill.
Any discussion of the amendment? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. A quick overview of this bill generally sets a new accounting standard for the health plans in the state of Minnesota. Right now, any organization or nonprofit or private sector business that does business and contracts with the state of Minnesota must comply with GAAP accounting. That's GAAP, generally accepted accounting principles. There's only one sector that does not comply with GAAP accounting, and that is the health plans, insurance industry and the health plans. So my bill simply is based on fairness, transparency, and accountability. We say if you're going to contract with the state of Minnesota, like everyone else, you open your books, you use GAAP accounting so that we can track public dollars and how they're spent. It's impossible to do that now with the accounting standards that they use. Additionally, this bill sets a requirement for a loss ratio and also allows the public right to audit the health plans. So these are all policy provisions that passed in previous committees. The fiscal note read zero on the first analysis and was sent back, came back with an additional zero. So I will stand for questions.
Are there questions? Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, on the fiscal note on page two, it says the DHS may seek donations to cover the cost of the waiver application. I think I'd like to see a fiscal note on one of my bills that says there's no cost and DHS may seek donations. Is that DHS may seek donations?
I think it sounds like maybe a question for someone from the department. Bill allows for donations. I don't see anyone coming forward from the department to speak to the issue of usually if there are donations they have to be appropriated.
Madam Chair, it
looks like some people are coming now.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Karen Peed with the Minnesota Department of Human Services. I am not aware of a circumstance where a state agency can seek donations to, I'm assuming that the question is there a precedent for a state agency seeking donations to seek a waiver? Is that the question?
Well, I think the question goes beyond that. Is, first of all, is it possible to do that? And secondly, if it is, wouldn't we have to appropriate whatever receipts you got back to you to spend? I mean, you can't just spend money because it's donated. It has to be appropriated.
Madam Chair, and members of the committee, I'm not aware of a circumstance where a state agency has sought donations for activities of this sort. The only circumstance I can think of where outside funds might be used outside of an appropriation might be if a grant were sought. Grants don't usually cover the process or are not usually dedicated to seeking a waiver. They are used to accomplish some other purpose.
Madam Chair.
Other questions? Senator Prettner-Solon.
Madam Chair, last year I tried to, there was a $60,000 note on a bill I had, and somebody was willing to make the donation, and it was not permitted.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Well, I have a couple of questions about that, Madam Chair. One is that it seems to me that we hear about the department seeking waivers for things all the time. You know, it's like part of what they do is look for waivers as things come up when they need them for particular things. And once again, sort of like the earlier question we had when we say when we want the department to look for cost savings in certain areas, we're told they can't do that unless we give them the money. But if the executive branch wants them to look for cost savings, it's just part of their job. And so it seems like seeking waivers is something that's fairly commonplace. So that's one comment that I have. Then the other question is, you know, again, I haven't been here a long time, but the one experience just in the last year that I know in education was when it came to looking at ways to implement Race to the Top. I think there was private sector money there that was donated through, I don't know if it was a grant, but it was given to the agency to pursue that. And I'm not sure exactly technically how that came about, but I know that that was private funding put into that effort.
Well, are there any other questions on the proposal at this time? Otherwise, we can take witnesses.
Well, Madam Chair, I've got one other comment about the fiscal note, if we could. The last sentence in the assumptions is just one of the craziest things I've ever seen. It says that if the health plans don't meet the loss ratio and pay a penalty, the costs will be included in their health plan's experience and raise the rates. I mean, so if we, you know, institute a rule and they break the rule and we penalize them, it becomes a cost of doing business that we pay for then in subsequent years. That makes no sense whatsoever to me.
Well, and Madam Chair, that was another thing I wanted to raise. That's not something that's in the bill. That apparently is something that the department is assuming that the plans would have the right to do, and I can't imagine, like with Senator Lori, why we would possibly decide that we are going to repay them for a penalty based on their violation of the law. And why would the department build that assumption into a fiscal note?
All I have to say is that'll teach them.
Senator Lori.
Madam Chair.
Senator Erickson Rhodes.
Thank you very much. To Senator Lori and Senator Olson's point, I think you're starting to see the tip of the iceberg for some of the mechanisms that are allowed to go on within the health plans that we have no oversight over whatsoever. And if they build things in like this, or there's a capacity, and again, this is not my bill giving permission to do this, so I'm going to be very clear, this is the department saying, this is how we will deal with penalties. I think every single one of us, perhaps as lawmakers, then if we are caught speeding or accused of tax evasion and have to pay some penalties, should be asking the taxpayers to bail us out. And that's exactly the kind of manipulation of dollars that happens right now because we do not have an open book system. We absolutely need to go to the gap accounting for the health plans in the state of Minnesota. Again, this is about transparency. We spend $3 billion. We give it over to the health plans to the state of Minnesota to deliver health care to the state's poorest of the poor and sickest of the sick, deal with these health plans. And there is no method for us to track the dollars. We don't do this in any other program. I think the main question here that all of you should be asking is, where do we spend our public dollars in public health programs for Minnesotans, and why aren't we even interested in trying to track those dollars? They go into a black hole. We get a report back saying, everything's great. We did great this year. And we all say, oh, thank you very much. And we go on. No other department or division or contract in the state of Minnesota deals with public dollars this way. We have no way to track this money to find out how much is being spent on administration and how much is going to direct care. We, in this bill, we establish a loss ratio. There has been a loss ratio established for insurance plans in the state of Minnesota previously, but only for commercial plans, never for public plans.
Well, Senator, that's not exactly true. We did reduce the amount that was allowed for their administrative costs in our budget last year. And when the contract is drawn up, it is drawn up not as a block grant, but it is drawn up based on the various parts of the rate, one of which is the administrative costs.
And Senator Berglund, we still are struggling with how we define administrative costs as well. So I think that is addressed in Senator Dahl's bill. But there's still a lot of wiggle room, and we cannot track that money. So even though we say you can spend this amount of money for administrative costs, we don't have any way to track that to see if that actually is happening.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This was a point that was raised by in the meeting that I had a couple of weeks ago in Bemidji when we were talking about what's in federal health care reform legislation and the fact that there's going to be at least a floor set at the federal level, or there has been a floor set that will be implemented for the loss ratio with regard to the health plans. And after that presentation, one of the healthcare providers or administrators at that meeting said, well, who gets to define the administrative costs and how are we going to track that? Because if we give the insurance companies the ability to define that and track it using their own systems, then we might as well not even bother to have the law because it'll essentially be meaningless. And my response to that is that I think both at the state level and at the national level, that's exactly the kind of dialogue that we're trying to have and get a handle on. And something we've been struggling with for as long as I've been here. I remember, and I think I've said this before, but I remember testimony in a subcommittee hearing we had, or a task force that we had from the Department of Commerce, where at least in some circumstances, reinsurance of the insurance company's risk of loss was being considered as a healthcare cost and not a medical cost. Oversight for pre-approval of health procedures was not being considered an administrative cost. That's considered a healthcare cost. Now, I don't think there's anything in this bill that would change any of that, but it at least provides some transparency with regard to those kinds of practices so that we can take a look at how these costs are being considered and analyzed. And with respect to the other issue having to do with being able to bill again for penalties, it seems to me that that's an assumption that would provide reason not to see some savings with this bill. Because right now, if there are plans that are exceeding the requirements that we have in law, and there's either going to be a reduction in what they're going to be paying, which can be built back into care, or there's going to be some savings for the state. Assuming that we're going to have to pay them back for the savings we'll see to make these reductions is an assumption I've never seen in any other fiscal note before. So I really think we should be seeing some savings in our fiscal note rather than having these kinds of assumptions by the department.
Mr. Koontz.
Thank you. My name is David Koontz. I am here today speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Provider Coalition. The purpose of our support of this bill is the transparency issue that we're having a discussion on right now. That's our number one issue. We are not, it has been said to us on many occasions that the reason we want transparency is so we know what the payment rates are going to be in HMOs, commercial business, and so forth. This bill does not deal with that, and that's not our interest. Our interest as providers and taxpayers and small business is that when we have a government program, that we believe we have a right to know where the money is being spent and allocated. That's what this bill is about. And we started out by, through this process, we've learned a lot. And what we have really learned is we don't have much chance of getting transparency unless we do a bill of this nature, because we were told early in the process that everything was audited and it was all right. But when we got to the Senate Health Policy Committee, we found out that there is no audit of the $3 billion expenditure. So what we are trying to do is provide for a loss ratio so that we know where the state monies are being spent. We want to provide for a private right to audit. If the state doesn't have the money to do the audits, we'll pay for it as providers. If you don't want to do that, then you go ahead and audit. But what we're saying for the record is we now have testimony that nobody is auditing $3 billion of state expenditures. And we had that both in testimony in the Senate and we had it in the House. We asked them for the use of GAAP accounting systems because the GAAP accounting systems requirements are standard. We know how to read those accounting principles. But we also reviewed the NAIC accounting principles that the department provided us. And what it says is this government program is not an insurance program. And so all these rules and all these things are to protect the solvency of insurance companies. That's all they do. And so then we said, well, with health care reform, what's going to happen if we use NACI accounting? Because under NACI accounting, it says that they have the right and to change the accounting principles and the way they report so that they maintain their solvency. And we said, gee, what is that going to do? And 2 days later, the Wall Street Journal and Reuters reports Blue Cross Blue Shields under the new federal program that is going to require 85% loss ratio, they are already changing their definitions for administration and moving it over to provider expense. So now if you call Blue Cross Blue Shield or that entity that they're doing and you complain about your bill in that, that is being charged off to provider expense. So we think it's a slippery slope, that definition, and we can't get to where the money's going. So that's where we're at. We must be able to have data, and right now you can't get to the data. And we think it behooves you to do that. We think this bill is a good start. You know, we're in a crisis. Last night we were hearing 85 people over in the House. You had 75 people here talking about health care reform and all the cuts. And what was interesting, late in the evening, one of the small HMO providers testified they had used their antitrust exemption that insurance companies and HMOs have, and they had divvied up the market with UCare. They had chosen to do the public program or private business, HMO business, and they gave UCare all of the MA business. And they were there last night saying, my goodness, you're now putting a 2.5% assessment on us, and that will bankrupt us and we'll have to go out of business. You have to save us. And I was sitting there going, holy cats, we just had bail out the banks. We just had bail out AIG. What does the public think of that? And now we've got a proposal that they're asking all the legislators say bail out the smallest HMO because we can't. We got to keep them going.
Mr. Kuntz, I just think I need to correct something you just said. There is no plan in Minnesota that is exempt from antitrust. We do not require every plan to bid for state business. So they may be, this plan that you're describing may have chosen not to bid to be a provider in our state business, but they're not exempt from antitrust. There is no plan in Minnesota that's exempt from antitrust.
Well, then Senator Berglund, I hope that whoever, the testifier made a mistake because divvying up market share is antitrust activity. And if you don't have an exemption, it's antitrust. I'm not an antitrust attorney, but that we are briefed on regularly. and providers cannot do those things. Now, that was in public testimony, so I'm going to move on, and I'll finish by saying we have a lot at stake on this, and there's a lot of people being hurt, and we need to know where the money goes. So I ask you to support Senator Erickson wrote bill.
Madam Chair, to your point about the antitrust issue, perhaps the Department of Commerce could speak to that. I know they're here. But I believe, and I've been told, that the McCarran-Ferguson Act, it's a federal act, exempts them.
But we have state antitrust laws also that don't exempt anybody.
Then it's interesting because the testimony given at the House last night sounds like there's some conversation between health plans.
Well, that may be, but I they're not exempt from antitrust, so somebody should bring a lawsuit if they think they have, or ask the Attorney General to investigate if they think somebody's breaking the antitrust laws. Are there any questions for Mr. Koontz? Now, thank you very much. The next witness is Julie Bruner.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Julie Bruner. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, and I want to thank you for the chance to testify on the bill this morning. I just have to start out by saying that the testimony last night, I was not at the hearing, but what I understand is that Preferred One, which is a small commercial plan, has a contract with UCARE. This is transparent, it's well known. It certainly is not in violation of antitrust law at all. And I don't know a lot about it. If you want additional information, we certainly can provide that. But there is nothing improper about the relationship that Preferred One and UCARE have established for many years. There's no antitrust violation, and it was nothing like carving up the market. So I really regret that that's been laid out on the table, and we will certainly follow up with the committee to get you the facts on that situation. Senate File 2986 is a bill that creates new and inconsistent mandates on health plans in Minnesota and will add to administrative costs and burdens of health plans. Section 1 of the bill establishes new requirements related to medical loss ratios that health plans must meet. Provisions in the new federal health reform legislation address the medical loss ratios that plans must comply with. And the National Association of Insurance Commissioners is currently, at the request of the Secretary of HHS, developing recommendations for medical loss ratio definitions and terms. And my understanding is that those provisions are to be submitted to the HHS Secretary sometime in May, and those will go into federal regulations. So we're waiting to see what the proposed regulations for MLRs will be. But that's being addressed at the federal level. There's no way to know what the MLR requirements in the new bill are going to be, but what we need are consistent MLR requirements across all plans and all lines of business. It doesn't make sense to us for you to establish different definitions at this point in time. You've already put administrative caps on the health plans for public programs. I feel like I'm just screaming.
Actually, people back here can't hear you very well.
That's a first. Sorry. Administrative caps are already in statute for the health plans for public programs. The pressure from the legislature and from private purchasers to keep administrative costs low has been a factor for some years in keeping Minnesota's HMO administrative costs low, and they are some of the lowest in the country. The loss ratios for the health plans in Minnesota aren't the problems with what's wrong with health care. It's the rising cost of health care, not redefining medical loss ratios for plans in Minnesota. The way a medical loss ratio calculation is drafted in this bill is on lines 2.5 to 2.7. The health plan will be required to include the administrative expenses of providers into their medical loss ratio calculations. This is not only difficult, but it might require the authority for health plans to audit providers' books to try to determine how much is administrative in their costs. There's no way to control administrative costs of the plans if now we're going to have to include administrative costs from providers in the calculation for the plans. The medical loss ratio math does not work in the bill. The bill requires a 93.5 medical loss ratio. Currently, the law requires that plans expend no more than 6.6% of revenue on administrative costs for public programs. When you add, and you have to add, premium taxes and provider surcharges, you don't want them added to medical costs. They're logically administrative costs. When they're added, the total is 8.1%. That would mean, at most, the medical loss ratio would be 91.8, not 93.5. The legislature assumes, and the department assumes, that the plans will have some margin in doing business with the state. Even a 1% margin, which is probably what the department shoots at, and the department can speak to that, would again bring the medical loss ratio closer to 90%, not 93.5%. Given the federal activity on this issue and the potential for conflict and potential inconsistent requirements with new federal regulations, we request that the committee reject this proposal. I know that both the Commerce Department and DHS have observations and comments on this issue as well. Section 2 of Senate File 2986 requires the plans to maintain gap accounting for their government programs. Once again, this is inconsistent with the way the plans have operated for several decades in complying with state requirements. DHS, Commerce, and the Health Department and the federal Medicare program, I understand, require statutory accounting. We know that the NAIC and HHS requirements related to the new federal reform will be in statutory accounting principles, not gap accounting principles. A requirement to maintain two sets of books that providers have an easier time auditing and assessing what they're being paid to each other just doesn't make sense to us. The costs of maintaining those two sets of books will raise administrative costs for the plans in doing public programs, and the department is required to include those costs in the rates that they set. Section 3 of the bill does nothing to control health care costs at all. In fact, we think it'll increase costs. Health care expenditures are a product of the amount of care that is consumed or used by patients and the cost of that care, which is paid out to providers in their rates. This section would give providers access to every health plan's books related to costs and expenses that go into determining medical loss ratios. That's essentially going to be an open book for providers to look at what health plans are paying to all their competitors. They can go in and see what every other provider is being paid. That's an unusual way to control health costs, and one of the things that the state has contracted with the plans for over the years is try to keep costs down. The plans are under incredible scrutiny and audit. They do many reports, hundreds of reports. I don't understand, since these reports are public, why the Provider Coalition, or I'm not sure, Mr. Kuntz's group, doesn't go in and try to take a look at what is already available. The plans will be under close scrutiny to comply with all the new federal requirements, including the medical loss ratio requirements. The concept that provider groups can audit books and challenge the plan's calculations, which are already going to be audited by state and federal auditors, is pointless because the federal law is going to trump how the plans have to set up their books. The legislature has a regulatory scheme established to monitor the health plans through the Commerce Department, through DHS, and through the Health Department. And we believe that the scheme and the model and framework that you have set up right now is adequate. We would ask that the committee not support this bill.
We are going to have to come back because we go into session in about a minute. And when we come back, I have some questions I'd like to ask Ms. Peed. So we will plan to reconvene about 15 minutes after session adjourns. And with that, we'll be in recess.
If I leave this, then like I want to save this for later.
Yeah, I'm going to see if we can just leave everything.
We leave our stuff here?
Oh, okay. So it all stays.
Okay.
All right.
So you're going to be.
Okay, that makes sense.
You could just leave this
here. Yeah.
I got it.
What?
On the kettle?
I don't want to be a writer. I was going to suggest that you need.
I know. That's
crazy.
Okay.
That's a dangerous little stretch of the road.
Yeah, printed off.
Are you a paddler?
I got two kayaks.
Are you going up?
Well, I don't think I'll do that.
Were you guys here late last week?
I heard about that. Yeah.
You don't have a very big bill.
Probably.
September, October, November.
Oh, yeah. Then I have no.
Yeah, it's
but ask, you know, just ask about Lewis.
There's up in St. Louis.
I've got a long body.
I go to
Right.